some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Good evening, everybody. This is your host, Garrett Miller, and I'm thrilled to have you here. We are, you know, some weeks I go through this phase, and I don't do it consciously, even though I'm the one that schedules every guest. But some weeks we go through the phase where it's like super gay radio, and we talk about LGBT issues all week. And then other weeks it's like the psychic hotline, and we have a bunch of psychics on. And then this is the week that we have a bunch of authors on the show. And I never book more than one per week, and usually no more than like one every 2 weeks or one a month, just simply because I want to make sure I get to read the book that the author is going to be talking about. If they've been nice enough to send it to me or want to talk about something that they are interested in, it's, you know, my duty as a radio personality here to actually take the time to read it. So last night we had Bilson Kay on. He's the singer, songwriter, bass player for Neil Diamond, but he's also written a book called The Amazing Adventures of a Marginally Successful Musician. If you're anything to do with entertainment, it's a must read. You must go buy it. You can get it on BilsonKay.com. And then we have David Swatling, who's going to be on the show in just a minute. We are going to be talking about his book called Calvin's Head. And I never read a book in a day, ever. I finished the book at 6:46 p.m. and was breathing a sigh of relief. I just wanted to get through like the first half of the book, but I couldn't put it down. So we're going to be talking to David in just a minute about that. And then Thursday, we jump ahead a day. Tomorrow we're going to be talking to Richard Wynn of Wynn Locations, Hollywood set rentals from around the valley for commercial locations like bars and restaurants and boardrooms and things like that. Can't wait to talk to Richard. But on Thursday, we have Chris Ando from St. Louis, his book, Delusions of Grandeur, a 5-star rating on Amazon. He's going to be our guest. So that makes 3 authors in a week. So I must be insane because I'm reading every single one. And it's my my pleasure to actually have read today's guest book, you know, from David Swatling, Calvin's Head. We're going to talk all about that. Before that, though, how do I even introduce somebody who has such a fantastic career and is such a dynamic national figure as David is in his new, well, I don't know if it's fair to say new homeland of Amsterdam, but he has been in Amsterdam for years and years and years and has really developed quite an amazing career. We're going to talk to him in about that in just a real quick second. But I want to give one last programming note. Mr. Joseph Strider, our Friday night dance party guest, we're actually, I told the other day, we're going to start it a little bit earlier. We're even bumping it up further for a 3 p.m. start time. That's California. I know it's early. It's like a Friday afternoon dance party, but we're doing this because Joseph Strider has been nice enough to do the show earlier because I've been invited to go to see Sasha's Block perform in Beverly Hills at the K-Jazz Jazz Festival, where they're a headlining act. And Alex Gershman, who's the lead singer, of course, you remember him. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and they've been on when we were doing the world premiere for their album Heart on Fire. He invited me to go and see the band play again. And I was moving, what they say, hell and high water to make that happen. So big thanks to Joseph Strider, but also big thanks to Mary Lou Monroe Ray, who will be doing the show live from Brisbane, Australia at a very early 7 a.m. her time. I think I've got that timing right. I may be off by a couple of hours, but it's something wickedly early. And Mary Lou is more of a night person, if you know what I mean. So she is putting all of her smiles on full force on Friday morning to do the interview with Joseph Strider. So thanks to everybody for that. Now, as I love to say, without further ado, it is my distinct honor and pleasure to welcome David Swatling to the show to talk about Calvin's Head. David, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Garrett. I'm excellent, especially after hearing all those wonderful things you said and the fact that you finished the book today. I can't believe it. Hello? Hello? Oh, what do I have to do? Hello? Hello? unmuted. Hello? Oh, crap. Hello?
Hi, this. David, how are you?
Can you hear me now?
Well, now, okay. So for whatever reason, my Direct Connect link that I'm bragging to everybody about is going absolutely fantastic, except that you can't hear me. And I thankfully have Tony out of Hackensack, New Jersey, saying, I can hear you, but we can't hear David. And now suddenly they couldn't hear me. So I'm calling in off of a regular phone line, too. So my apologies for what we're going to call a tardy start. We're tardy to the party. I'm tardy to the party, I guess. But
hey, I'm
now,
always
here we go.
To the party. It's part of my life.
Anyway, so I will say that I don't know what happened technologically speaking, but it's one of those, you know, I'm glad that I had a phone line sitting here ready and waiting. And like I was telling you before, I've never had a guest not try to call in or anything like that, so knock on wood. And I'm going,
listen,
you know, I know David's there.
When I go on computers, as soon as, like, my fingers touch the keyboard, they say, aha, it's him. What can we do to him today?
Right. Well, I think there might be some Mercury retrograde stuff going on if I'm, you know, remembering. Let's see, but that's from September 17th through October 9th. But so maybe it's just like a little bit of retrograde stuff coming into it to get us a little bit beforehand. Anyway,
I wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, thank you for your great introduction. That's what I was trying to say broadcasting.
Well, I was like, I'm so sorry. It's so much more I wanted to say about you, but you know, I'm going to say this. It's my show, so if we run a couple minutes long tonight, it's because, well, we can. So there. So anybody having anything to say with Mercury retrograde, screw you tonight. What I wanted to say is I normally don't get a chance to read an author's book in its entirety before having them on the show. And you and I talked earlier today, and we had this little thing called weather happen early this morning. And I say early, starting at least where I live around 2:30. And by 5 a.m., my house was flooding. And this is for everybody who's outside of Los Angeles who says, you know, it rains all the time everywhere. That's great. But where I live, it rain puddles and pools and then coagulates and comes directly into my room in my office. And so at 5 a.m., I'm struggling to find a garden hose, get the sump pump thing out, and get water going in a different direction than inside the house and hopefully out into the alley. So by the time I get all of this done, it's still raining. It's pouring. We had like 2.5 inches of rain here in a very short period of time today. I know L.A. did as well. And I emailed David and said, David, I can't meet you for lunch, because we were originally going to meet for lunch at the fantastic CBS studios, I think is where we're going to meet today. And so we had a very nice conversation on the phone. What that indirectly did, David, though, was it gave me time to read the rest of your book. And I couldn't stop this afternoon. I read it absolutely until the very last word, and at the time of, you know, I finished with the book was like 6:46 this evening, 15 minutes before
the
show.
Amazing. Well, that, I'm very honored. It makes me really happy to hear.
So do everybody a favor. I mean, I've had the great privilege of talking to you just a little bit today, and then, you know, before the show, I've had a chance to read your book, so I've kind of got a little bit of a flavor about who you are. But can you do me a huge favor and tell the listeners who are hearing your name and your voice and about Calvin Said for the first time tonight, share a little bit about you?
Sure. Well, let's see. Well, if we go all the way back, I grew up in upstate New York in a really rural small town called Half Moon, kind of farm country. Both my grandparents were farmers, and you know, I spent most of my childhood just waiting to get away. I remember mowing the lawn, fantasizing that some Hollywood producer was going to drive by and whisk me away to Hollywood and make a remake of Huckleberry Finn or something like that, and
right,
get me out of there. But you know, I did get away when I went to college and did kind of pursue this. I was studying theater and wanted to be an actor, and I went to Syracuse University for 4 years, and then I headed to New York City, bright lights, big city, instead of Hollywood. And I did okay. I had a little off-Broadway debut in a little play called The Passion of Dracula, which was a kind of a surprise thing, because I was actually working in the box office when not one but two actors got sick, and they only had one understudy, and somebody said, oh, you know all the lines. You've heard them every night. You can do it tomorrow night. So I just
that's not
in.
You know, that's not scary at all.
No. Especially, I knew all the lines, but what I didn't know was that Jameson, the butler, had so much business with props. It was terrifying. I didn't care about Dracula. It was like, is the tea set properly?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, yeah, so that was...
You got through that, and then how did you end up across the pond in Amsterdam?
Well, you know, the thing is, I went out to L.A. for 6 months to try my hand out here and didn't get much further than being a regular space cadet on Jason of Star Command. And I went back to New York, and, you know, it wasn't going so great. Everybody was saying, oh, when you get into your early 30s, you're going to be very castable. And I thought, well, why should I bang my head against the wall for the next 5 years? I'll just stop for a while. But if you stop doing the one thing you're really passionate about, that you've really been wanting to do your whole life, it leaves kind of a hole that has to be filled. And in the East Village in the early 80s, there was a lot to fill holes with of all kinds of terrible things.
Sure.
I dressed in black, I bleached my hair blonde, and I went out to nightclubs, and I got into lots of trouble. And I just realized I got to get out of here, that things are going really badly. And I was in a bar one night, and someone raised their hand and said, anybody want to sublet an apartment in Amsterdam? And in 3 weeks, I was gone.
Wow!
Quit job, sold stuff, whatever I could, and just packed my bags and left. And, I mean, actually, the apartment had fallen through by the time I got to Amsterdam, even before I left. But I was determined to just, like, make a go of it because this was kind of, like, last chance. And I found this little theater community of English-speaking theaters there, and bam, suddenly I was acting again, directing again. I got the job in Radio Netherlands, which kind of paid my bills because the little theater companies didn't, and it was a whole new life, another little reinvention, as it were.
And, you know, when you get over there and you're doing all of these things, I mean, did you just have just like the biggest smile on your face all day long, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
I wrote a kind of a screenplay version of all of that once, and I remember this person from the film studio in Amsterdam who read it and said, I really, really like it, but it's just too much like a fairy tale. No one would believe it.
Well, you know, there is a little bit of that.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. Yeah.
So we're going to talk about your book, Calvin's Head, and I want to spend – really just weeks talking about this because I had so much fun reading this today. But before we do that, you have spent years and years and years as an accomplished radio host yourself, hosting, let's see, I think the show's called Alien, and you've written for some various publications over in Amsterdam too. So how do you, when you started doing your show Alien, how did that get started and how did it become such a hit for the LGBT community?
Well, I had been working for Radio Netherlands worldwide first. I was just doing arts and culture programs, history programs, and then a friend of mine was involved in this show Alien on local Amsterdam radio, 2 hours live every Sunday evening, and she said, "Why don't you come in and do it?" I had been going through kind of a difficult time because this was 1995, which is kind of when the book begins in a set, and so I said, "Oh, okay." I mean, I sat there for the first time I came into the studio, terrified, because I was used to doing crafted, produced, edited radio. You know, just it was all done in advance. This
right.
was just sitting around talking live for 2 hours, and I was like, I can't do this. I can't talk like this. And but little by little, I got used to it and enjoyed it. It was a great team of people. I ended up doing it for 12 years. And yeah, it was. We would start out with like serious news, which back then, you know, you had to find wherever you could because this was the very beginnings of the internet, you know, and so there wasn't a lot there. But we would find news stories, talk about them, and then as the show progressed, it got a little bit lighter and lighter, and by the end we were just giggling ourselves silly over stories about the lesbian sheep, or I would sometimes in the middle of the show read a little 10-minute porno story with music that the technician would you know, she would just sort of pick something and go, oh, that sounds good. I'm going to play this. And I would just go with it. You know, it was total anarchy and sometimes chaos, but it was fantastic. And the thing is, I stopped doing it because after 12 years, the internet sort of took over in terms of information. When we started, we were the, you know, nobody else was getting the information about gay and lesbian issues and bringing people in to talk about that stuff. The radio was really the one way that people could sit home alone in their room and listen and hear about people like them. And I think that was really important at the time. But, I thought it was really important. And then toward the end, I maybe got a little tired, and I thought, okay, it's not as urgent that we keep doing this, you know, every week. And I started to do other things. So,
well, I'm grateful that you started to do other things, because ultimately this led to the book that you're here to talk about tonight, Calvin's Head. So how did you, and by the way, I won't spoil anything, but there were so many twists and turns in here. I said, this should be on like Days of Our Lives. I said that more than once today in the reading of the book. And I actually said that to my roommate as well. I said, Marcus, you will not believe what happens in section three of this book. David told me I had to get to section three. And when I got to section three and got to that point, I went, oh, I can't stop now. And so I think that was really why I finished the book. But until the very end, which again, everybody who's listening to this tonight, they're going to have to actually read the book to figure out what's going on. But I liked the last page of the book where you were talking about your experience. But what is Calvin's Head about? You clue us in and share excitement here.
I think the best way to clue you in or to clue people in is just to say that, and this is all true, in 1995, I was homeless, living in my Jeep with my dog Calvin in Amsterdam. And the reasons behind that are kind of too boring to go into, but it was just the summer that I was actually in the Jeep. I had places to live most of the time, but there was like a 6-week period during the summer where it was just me and the dog in the Jeep. And we're walking in Vondel Park in the middle of Amsterdam one morning, gorgeous park, beautiful sunny day, and there's this big crowd of people around one of the ponds right by the gay cruising area, which is the Rose Gardens, which is still active. There were police lines and policemen were interviewing people, and there were divers in the pond. And I said to somebody, what happened? And they said, somebody's dog pulled a garbage bag out of the pond, and in it was a human head. And my one thought at the time was, thank God not Calvin, because he's a big white golden retriever, and that's what they do for business, you know. That's the game. I was like, oh wow, I'm so glad we didn't come here earlier. And but then I got thinking, and I was like, you know, here I am homeless. I thought, well, what if it was Calvin? What if I recognized the victim, and instead of telling the police what I know, I moved into his house, and that was the beginning of the story. That's where the story goes. Because once he moves into the house, that's when things get really strange. As if the opening isn't strange enough. So,
well, there is so much that's strange about the book, but it's one of those. It's not like, you know, it's not like the book ends with the Loch Ness Monster, UFOs, and Bigfoot all getting together and singing a kumbaya. Everything that happens is kind of believable, you know, and you're like, I can see this. No, don't do this. Oh, and you want to scream out and yell at these characters. Don't, you know, like, don't go up the stairs, like they always say in the horror movies. But you know, like, don't go up the stairs. And there's so much of this that goes on.
Way, I've always loved thrillers. I mean, I like reading, especially psychological thrillers, like Patricia Highsmith and people like that. But there was someone I was reading at the time, back in the late 90s, named John Morgan Wilson, who wrote a gay mystery. It won the Edgar Award for Best Debut Mystery Novel. And there was he had a very dark kind of protagonist who was always doing the wrong. I mean, he'd meet a hustler and you'd go, don't sleep with that hustler. And of course, Benjamin Justice would sleep with the hustler.
I
know, there was just something about the interaction. I considered Benjamin Justice my first literary boyfriend. You know, I wanted to like save him. And I liked that thing. So I think in that sense, I was really inspired by that. But I have to say, I wrote the first couple chapters a couple years after the incident in the park with a writing group in New York in Amsterdam. And I was walking the dog one day, and I got this vision of this scene in my head, and I went, I can't write that. No one would believe that. That can't happen. And I threw the manuscript in a drawer, and I didn't look at it for 13 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I think I wasn't ready to write it then.
No, yeah.
once I retired from the radio station and had some time and thought I've got to, you know, write something or do something creative again, you know, I thought let's find out why that happened. Let's see where we go from there. And you know, there were surprises in the book for me as I was writing it too. So I think that's a good sign.
So how long did it take you to actually – well, let me ask you this, because we talked about this, but really I don't know if I got an answer by the time we ended our conversation earlier today, but what do you consider the difference between a writer and an author?
Well, you know, when I started writing the book, I did it – I wrote the first draft in a month. There's this thing called the National Novel Writing Month in November, and the idea is to write 50,000 words in 30 days. And I did that. And that's all I was focused on, just writing the story. And I put it away for a few months, and then I looked at it again, and I thought, oh, you know, this isn't so bad. Maybe I could work with this. As a writer, I'm just focusing on the getting a story told and getting it the best story I can. Once you go into the next phase, which is trying to get it published, meeting agents and sending it to publishers, then suddenly you have to switch into kind of an author mode, because you've told the story, but now you're getting into the business side of things. And especially once the book is published, then that kind of takes over. And so, I mean, the last year, the book came out last September, you know, has been a lot of promotion and events to go to and, you know, just the nuts and bolts of, you know, getting the book out there. Because as a debut author, you know, nobody knows who you are, and you have to try and sell yourself.
Got to kiss a lot of babies and shake a lot of hands. What's the one story or one question you hate having to tell again and again? You don't have to go into, like, major detail, but, you know, you do all these interviews and you meet all these folks. What's the one thing that's like, oh, my God, if they ask me that question one more time, my head's going to explode?
Well, I think the one that it just seems so obvious to me, you know, when they say, oh, where do you come up with these ideas? Well, from my life, actually, you know, for whether it's things I read or things. I mean, there's stuff in this book about Vincent van Gogh. Well, I did a lot of programs about van Gogh for Radio Netherlands. So I got all this base, you know, information in my head, like a little encyclopedia. I can't always access it when I want. And when I was writing the first draft, I would write stuff. And then in rewrites, I would have to go and find sources where I could check. Is that really true? Did that happen? You know, because I don't trust my memory at all. But, you know, you just and I'm a believer in organic writing. For instance, there was one day when I wasn't sure what to write next, so I thought, I'm going to call my friend, and he was he said, I don't really feel like talking today. I just came home from a funeral, and I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. Okay, I'll call you back in a few days, and I got off the phone, and I went back to the keyboard, and I wrote a funeral scene. I just took all that energy from him. Now, it didn't turn out to be in the right place. I ended up moving it later, but you know, that kind of energy I think you can use, and you know, that's the way that I like to go with it, you know, just let it happen.
So when you go through your writing process, you know, and I love to ask writers this because I think everybody does it just a little bit differently. In the almost 4 years that I've done this show, I think everybody that has been an author on this program without fail has always had their own unique spin on this. But how do you like to write? Are you a pen and paper guy, or are you a computer guy? Where do you do your best writing?
Well, I generally write on the computer.
Okay.
Although if I'm stuck, I will sometimes take a yellow pad and go off and see what happens there, and then go back to the computer. When I was developing Calvin's Head, a lot of stuff I wrote in a journal while I was walking the dog, and taking notes and things like that that I might be able to use later. But now I generally just write straight through on the computer. I write in order. To me, it has to be. I have to tell the story in a linear, consecutive way, even though it bounces around a lot. But I have to start at page one and end up with the end all in a row. Not that it's going to stay that way, But it's funny when you talk about process, because my sister asked me that, and I was having a little trouble with the second book, which I'm still working on. And she said, "Well, you know, what's your process? What was it for the first book?" I said, "Yeah, but it was just the first book, so I don't know what my process is." Because the first book is
you don't know what you don't know.
Then yeah, and now I'm writing slower. I mean, you get nominated for an award, and you think, "Oh my God, this has to be better than the first book," you know. So it's you can get blocked easier, and you have to work through that. And so but in general, I don't outline in advance. I have some idea of where the story might be going, but I just see what's going to happen. And, you know, I like getting surprised. I like having a character show up or I mention a character, and then suddenly I think, oh, I really like this character. He's not gonna go away yet. He's gonna stay in here for a while. As a matter of fact, I like him so much, I think I might kill him. You know, it's like, I like that kind of process, as opposed to what a lot of writers do, which is do a very strict outline, chapter by chapter, and then fill in the dots. I think
fill in the dots.
I don't, yeah.
What? For your first novel out, you know, for everybody who's listening tonight, you have been nominated for the Lambda Literary Award as a finalist this year. Your book is published by Bold Strokes Books, and the category, I think, is film noir. And let me tell you that it is just one of these things that, you know, from a reader perspective, one of the things that I really appreciate how you write, David, is that you write intelligently, but you don't feel the need to give the readers a bunch of $8 words, so you can feel very impressed with yourself that you used your thesaurus key on the computer to come up with a different word for ran away or whatever the case is. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why I found your book so easy to read, and why I just kept going page after page after page after page. And it's like, I've got to, you know, I've only got 40 more pages left to go, and I got 30 minutes before the show starts. I got to finish this book. I really enjoyed your writing style. So have you written other things? I know you said you're working on your second book, but what experience did you have to get you prepared to write a book compared to, you know, magazine articles or, you know, things for other publications that you've worked for?
Well, you know, I don't think that's so different, really. I mean, I worked for years in the radio station producing half-hour documentary-style programs. So there's a script, and there's a story to be told. Okay, it's a half-an-hour format, but there's still a beginning, a middle, and end. There's a build. There's got to be a climax, whether it's a emotional or a informational or some kind of, you know, thing. You got to hook people at the beginning, and then you've got to build. You've got to keep the tension going. I mean, in the best cases, you don't have time to do that every week. But and before that, I was doing theater, which, you know, is all about storytelling and structure.
Sure.
And I think those kinds of the storytelling aspect I've always been doing, you know, from when I was a kid, you know, entertaining my little brothers to through school and getting into theater and then moving into radio. So to me, putting it on the paper and writing novels is kind of a natural progression. And I like it because, you know, I don't think of like a whole big audience, but what I do think, I liked an author who once said, Jeffrey Eugenides, who wrote Middlesex, I heard him talk, and he said, you know, what I tell my students is write a novel like you're writing the best letter you ever wrote to your best friend. And that because you and your best friend have a kind of a common knowledge of things.
Right.
So you don't have to explain everything. And on the other hand, it's your best friend, and you want to tell them the story. You want them to really understand what's going on. So, I mean, that helps you to. So I'm not thinking, you know, like when I was doing radio, I wasn't thinking, oh, I've got to make this, you know, good for the people who are listening on shortwave in India and good for the people who are listening on the overnight service on NPR in America, you know, insomniac professors. I just sort of focus on one person that I'm telling the story to and go with it that way.
I love it. I'm not kidding you. When I read it, it's like you're telling the story just to me. It's not like you're trying to write it to anybody else. So that to me was just absolutely. You just got me in there with the first page of the book and starting to talk about what was going to be taking place. You know,
I think that comes from radio too, because radio. I still think radio is the closest thing to novels in that it's an intimate relationship between you, the speaker, and the listener. Mm-hmm. And just as the book is between the author and the reader. So, but there's kind of an intimate quality to storytelling on the radio that I think I really learned and tried to, you know, put in the stories. I read a lot of different kinds of books, but, you know, I don't care who they are, and I'm not going to mention any names. They might be the hottest, you know, American novelist going, but if in the first 100 pages they're messing around and trying to be all arty-farty intellectual literary style, I throw it out. I don't read it. I can't. I don't have time to waste on that. I want to be told a story.
Right. See. Well, then you can write all the books that I read, because that's exactly the type of book that I'm enjoying when I sit down to read it. I don't need a bunch of other, pardon my French, but I don't need a bunch of other crap. I just need a book that, you know, I can get into quick. The characters are great, and there's something that's going to keep me turning each and every page and going to the next thing. So when you got started on Calvin's Head, can you tell us a little bit about the characters that we're going to meet in the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the main character is Decker, who's sort of, you know, I guess, you know, kind of an alter ego-ish character, closest character to me, although there's, I wrote them all, so they're all close to me in one way or another. Then he goes to Amsterdam to as a student, and meets, and you kind of find this out gradually, meets this artist who he ends up having a thing with. And then they're together for a while, but that doesn't work out. And so that's one thread that's going along. There's this, the victim, we find out little bits about the victim, who was this Scottish guy that he met in a bar one night and had a brief fling with. And then there's the killer, Gadget. And it's not giving anything away, because, you know right from the very first chapter who Gadget is and what he's up to. And he's kind of a dark, disturbed young fellow. But kind of charismatic, too. I think it's important that a villain or a killer, that there be something attractive about them, whether it's, even if it's just their, how horribly psychotically clever they are, that you have to get into their head as well. That's what Patricia Highsmith is great at. I mean, you know, the Mr. Ripley stories.
Right.
You know, that's a great character. He's just so, and Matt Damon was like ideal casting, you know, in that film, for a character who's, you know, just has no morals, and yet you're just so fascinated by what is he going to do next? How is he going to get out of this? I mean, you're almost rooting for him. So, I mean, the whole idea, you know, as you know, from the beginning, we see these two characters, the Decker and Gadget, and we know, okay, so at some point they're going to meet. What's going to happen then? And that only happens like midway through the book, and then what happens is something entirely, I hope, unexpected.
It's completely, well, okay, and I will tell you, I'm the kind of person that when I go to a movie, I don't mind knowing what's going to happen at the end of the movie. You know, I really am not. I'm also the kind of person that if you tell me what happens at the end of the book, I'm still going to read the book. I did not see them meeting from a million miles away until it started, until you have it written in the book. And I'm like, no! And the whole thing just had me, you know, screaming. I'm glad I had the windows closed today, because the neighbors would have been saying, what is going on over there? But it kept going, no, no, no. And you even allude to that in your writing. It's like, you know, I don't remember the line, but there's a line in the book where the guy is talking to himself going, you know, I really need to be listening to my intuition on this. Shouldn't I? But yet he goes and, you know, and when you're chanting for him to just like turn the other way, get rid of this guy.
But that's a little bit of the function of the dog, you know, the Calvin, because
yeah.
dogs have this sense of thing, and in a certain sense, Calvin. I mean, I wanted to be very careful. I knew from the very beginning that I wanted the dog's point of view, but I didn't want to write one of those anthropomorphic dogs that talk like humans, that, you know, like the same TV shows we like and all that kind of stuff. That drives me nuts. I wanted to get to kind of the essence of the dog, because the dog is. The dog knows from the very beginning.
Yeah.
He's like, don't stay away from, go, no, 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 you know, and that's what the reader is going through as well. You know, it's like, pay attention to the fucking dog, you know, but
right.
The thing is, when you're in a really dire straits, like being homeless, your judgment is clouded because all you're thinking about is getting from step A to step B. You're not thinking about down the line. It's just what do I have to do to get there, to get through this day, to get through this day. And so you don't always make the right choices, and you just have to, you know, fix things. But that's what happens in whether it's farce or tragedy. People, you know, get caught up in circumstances and then are trying desperately to get out of them. And sometimes the harder they try to get out of them, the deeper the hole they dig for themselves.
I think that's what we find in this case. You know, and I hope I'm not giving anything away. Towards the end of the book, they're in a, you know, certain things happen, but you compare or you have a visit to a bullfight. And I loved how you described in great detail why there's really like three acts to any bullfight. And then I was reading that and going, boy, you could really apply that to your book too. Was that intentional, David?
Well, you know, a little bit. I mean, one of the things that I did not write in the first draft was this road trip to Arles that happens in the book and the south of France. But when I reread the first draft, I thought, now that this is where a lot of development is going to happen, you've got to write that whole section. It turned out to be like a third of the book. But what I didn't know when I started the rewrites is that there was this active bullfighting arena, old ancient arena in Arles, where they still today have bullfights. And I thought, well, if you're writing a thriller and you got a killer in it, you got to use the bullfight.
Yeah.
The bullfight somehow. But I had read years ago Hemingway's Death in the Afternoon, which is his nonfiction book about bullfighting. And so I went back to that, and he's the one that sort of breaks down the structure of that. And I reference him in the book as well. It's not like I'm plagiarizing Hemingway, but it's the way he as a novelist looked at the art of bullfighting, whether you agree with it or not, but in terms of how the whole stage is set and what the points of view are. And of course it just, as I was looking at that stuff, it was tying in with the mind of a killer too, and especially the kind of killer who considers his work an art and an art form. And I thought, well, that's, I got to use that. So
you have to. And I'm glad you did.
And of course, without giving anything away, that completely changed the ending.
Right.
The ending was completely different before, but once I got to the where I thought, oh, I'll just write the new part and stick on the ending that I wrote. No, the ending had to be completely changed, and I was really happy with that.
Well, in the book, Calvin said one of the things you talked about just a second ago is the fact that you wanted to include Calvin, who's the dog, as with a voice in the book. And I loved, and I didn't get the, I'm a little slow sometimes, so it took me a couple of chapters to pick up on this, and I was like, okay, fine, you get it. But you give the dog a voice at the beginning of every chapter, or in most chapters he has a say about what's going on, and it's very... It's almost telling. It's almost like fortune telling for what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter, for what is going on in Calvin's head and how happy or unhappy he is with life.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know how I came up with that particular style. I just, you know, for 14 years I lived with a dog, and you know, you just get to know the way they think, and you know, it just, that's what I was trying to portray. This kind, because they're always in the moment. You know, it's like Calvin had, you know, I could point one finger saying 1 minute, 1 minute, and he would just wait by the door and I'd be right there. If I said 2 minutes, 2 minutes with two fingers, that was lay down by the door because it's going to take a while. And if I said 5 minutes, he just went to his bed because that meant forever.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, because that's all they have. It's right now, it's coming up, or it's maybe never going to happen.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's, and so that kind of immediacy, and the way to portray that seemed to be poetry, because poetry crystallizes things. So I have this kind of blank verse poetry stuff. And when I first wrote it, they were all over the page, like E.E. Cummings, I don't know if you know that, which actually drove some people nuts. They couldn't bear it. And as a matter of fact, they hated it so much. But I thought, okay, I got to change this. I got to make this somehow more accessible. So I simplified, but I still kind of kept that kind of bare bones and Well, the only punctuation that I use is a slash, because I figure, you know, if a dog has punctuation, it's a stick.
Yeah.
So that's my little trick.
Well, I appreciate the voice as we were getting into the book, because you knew the dog was going to be the voice of reason, you know, because the dog has that exceptional judge of character for everybody he meets. And so, you know, knowing this is what's going through his head at this particular time, it's like, okay, we're still on the right track. I haven't totally gone off the rails yet, because, you know, Calvin's got his head on straight. So I appreciated that.
And there's almost nothing in the book that Calvin does that my own Calvin didn't do at one point or another. There are a few exceptions, of course, but there is a scene where, you know, Calvin's kind of traps a character in the hallway and won't let them leave, and snarling, and that actually happened. That something like that happened to me. I took this guy home one night, and Calvin was asleep in the other bedroom with my roommate, and so he didn't see the guy that night. And so anyway, the next morning, my roommate had gone off to work. I went into the bathroom to take a shower or something like that, and the guy who I brought home decided he wanted to leave. And he came out of my bedroom and was greeted at the doorway by Calvin, who stood there snarling and growling. And the poor kid, I thought he was going to pee in his pants. He was, like, terrified that this dog was going to attack him. And I came out and I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I really should have introduced you before I left. He's a little bit territorial that way. But, you know, and that... So that I ended up using that as a scene in the book too, because that's, yeah, they're just, it's the way dogs are, it's the way they respond, you know, and it makes sense.
They got to protect their master, or they're human, you know. That's it. So
yeah.
You were telling me something earlier today I'm very excited about, is the fact that you have Calvin's head. It's either coming out or just been released on audiobook. Can you tell us about that?
Oh yeah, it just the beginning of this month came out as an audiobook from Audible.com, and I was really excited because, you know, I did a lot of readings and stuff for the radio, and I thought, oh, I think this could be a really good audiobook. And when my publisher told me that Audible had they'd signed a contract with them, I said, oh, now, you know, should I call them up and tell them about my radio experience and that I should, you know, narrate it? And she said, well, maybe just let them do what they do. And I was like, oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, it's my first book, and I'm busy doing other things. Okay, fine. Anyway, I then found out who was the guy who was doing it. I listened to a couple of samples of him, and I thought he was great. I thought he was fantastic. And then he asked me, when they were just about ready to start recording, if I had any, you know, thoughts that I should give him. And I kind of wrote out a page of things, and I was like, oh, look at what you've done here in this book. There is an American in Amsterdam. There is a Dutch boyfriend. There is a Dutch antagonist killer. There's a Scottish guy. There's a French guy. There's all these. There's the dog. All these different voices. I'm like, this is going to be a lot of work. And I'm really pleased with the results. So I am glad I didn't do it myself, because I think I would have been really frustrated. I think he's done a great job, and yeah, so that's just out now. So if people prefer to be read to as opposed to reading, that's the one thing as a writer, as an author, I've discovered in the last year how many people don't actually read books. I mean, they listen to audiobooks, but they just say, oh, I don't read books. I read, you know, I read online, or I read, you know, magazine articles, things like that, but I don't read novels.
Wow.
I'm like, really? Wow. Okay. That's fine, I guess. But I was kind of shocked.
I don't know. I think I'm finding myself kicking and screaming going to the Kindle route, to be honest. And frankly, whenever I have authors on the show, I say, please do not send me your book. It's not that I don't love you, and it's not that I don't want your book. I just don't have room, bookshelf space, mm-hmm. storage space, or otherwise for a hard copy. So it's not a reflection on you. Trust me, please. So I'm really dragging myself kicking and screaming into that electronic empire that we all are using, including today when I read your book, Calvin's Head. But, you know, there is, to me, still nothing like holding a book in your hands and turning that page, or going back three chapters, or skipping ahead. And not that you can't do that with, you know, the electronic varieties, but boy, I love feeling that book in my hand.
Yeah, no, I do too. I mean, it's only in the last year and a half that I bought a Kindle and started reading stuff, because my publisher sends me everything they publish every month, which is about 10 or 12 books in the Kindle versions. Well, I can't read everything, but I can at least kind of get an idea of the authors that I'm going to meet. Like when I went to Nottingham to do a little festival this summer, I had a panel with four lesbian authors, so I managed to read all four of their books before I left. I immersed myself for 1 month in lesbian romance. We won't go into that.
Well, topic for another night.
Yeah, topic for another night. But I found I could read them faster on the Kindle. I could just like, well, it was easy to skip the scenes that I had trouble reading.
I get that, I think that's where, if electronically, I would be prone to try to skip more than if I have that book. And I don't know why there is a different level of guilt or shame associated with skipping ahead with a hardback than it is with something you're reading electronically. But I feel the same way. I'm not sure that I necessarily like that, but it is easier to cheat.
Yeah, no. And the thing about like books that, when you talked about wanting to go back and stuff, a friend of mine sent me her historical novel that she wanted me to read. It was a great book. I really enjoyed reading it, but she wanted me to write something about it. And I had finished the book, and I went on the Kindle, because she sent me a Kindle copy, and I went, how am I going to write about it? How am I going to find the stuff that I want to? Oh, man, this is really hard. So now I'm very, very aware that if it's a book that I think, okay, this is a little something I'm going to want to, you know, think about, write about, or refer to, I have to buy the hard copy. If it's something that I'm just going to read once for fun, you know, the Kindle version will be okay.
Yeah, I agree. Because boy, I just feel like I'm going to be struck down by lightning by saying this. In my like favorite books, I don't mind actually going in and underlining or highlighting a particular passage or something that's going on, and you know, because it's my book. But there's something a little sacrilegious to me about actually putting anything written inside a book other than the author's autograph.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I was a big, when I was at the radio station, I was reading a lot of stuff for author, you know, to do interviews with authors and stuff like that. I had little baby yellow Post-its that I just, you know, instead of underlining. But, you know, those little yellow Post-its are still in the books. You know, that's the way they go on the bookshelf. And I, like, pick up a book by John Irving and go, oh, I remember doing that interview. And, oh, yeah, look, oh, that part. Oh, yeah, I want to read this part again. And it's a nice way to go back to books.
So you are working on a follow-up to Calvin's Head. Is there any inside information you can tell us about the new book that's going to be coming out?
Well, I can tell you a little bit. It's called Corpus Calvin. Now, when I wrote Calvin's Head, I just thought of it as a standalone psychological thriller all by itself. I had no intention of carrying on with these characters. But almost the first couple of people who read it said, what's going to happen next? I was like, I don't know. I didn't think there was going to be a next.
Right.
I had no idea. And so, you know, as I was, I began starting to think, well, what could be next? Well, the last three summers, I spend most of my time, I'm based in northern New Hampshire in the White Mountains at a friend's inn. And it's a 19th century building.
Oh.
And it's she doesn't use the inn part anymore. She just runs the restaurant and pub. So basically, she lets me stay in the inn part all by myself. It's great.
Nice.
It's my own little personal writer's retreat. But since the beginning, I've been hearing these stories about it being haunted. And so I got this, and I, you know, I'm not a great one about repeating myself, and just the idea of using the same two main characters is like, well, okay, that's enough of a repetition. I don't like those books where every time the character goes to a new place, you know, he runs into a killer again.
Yeah.
Like, what is his karma? You know, because what you said about the book being believable, credibility is important to me. You know, that this could happen. So I thought, well, what if at the end of the last story, where they go off to New Hampshire, to the White Mountains? And actually, there was a couple of chapters of backstory that I had cut from Calvin's Head completely, like about his college friends. So I resurrected those college friends to be part of the new story based on this inn in the White Mountains that is haunted, and suddenly began to think about why might it be haunted, and there's a little Civil War thread that goes back. So hopefully the historical side will meet up with the contemporary side, and everything will be quite explosive at the end. So basically I'm writing a ghost story. You know, instead of, I'm just kind of switching genres with the same character, which, you know, something new. Other people do it, but people have said already, aren't you afraid you're going to lose your readers? I'm saying, look, I only wrote one book. How many readers do I have? If I can't, and if, you know, when I was making radio, every week my program was different. You know,
right.
I had a colleague of mine who said, you know, you don't stick to any one style. We never know what we're going to hear on your show. And I said, well, I think that's a good thing. I like that, you know. And if people don't, they don't have to follow. If they don't like ghost stories, fine. But maybe people who are a little afraid of serial killers will be more into ghosts. And if they like the ghost story, maybe they'll go back and read the other one. You know, I think they can cross fertilize each other in terms of readership.
Well, you know, there's one author that's out there today that's very popular, and I'm not going to say any names because we're here to sell your book, not that author's book. But there is two or three characters that this author uses in different series, but they maybe come together and have romantic trysts in this one book, and then they go off and do different things. But there's always like something that's, you know, bringing them back together, crossing paths. And for me, as a reader, I actually kind of thought that was a little comforting, because it's not like, okay, I've got to go out and relearn, you know, another cast of, you know, 10 characters, and why do I like Marge, and how come I don't like Billy, and, you know, what's wrong with this one, or boy, that one's really the character I like out of this one. You know, you're taking two of the most endearing characters out of, you know, Calvin's head, and you're carrying him through. So I think it's like building kind of like a legacy.
And their relationship it changes almost immediately in this book. And I'm almost finished with it, but I know it's not giving too much away to know that there's a little boy in the story, a little 10-year-old boy,
mm-hmm.
and Calvin, because he senses this boy is in trouble, Calvin becomes his mate in this story, his protector, and so while Decker's off trying to deal with, you know, things that are going on at the inn and what's going on, Calvin is busy keeping an eye on this little boy, because he's kind of the central key to the whole story. And so that makes it fun too. That makes it different. Because, you know, I think I've done all of the Calvin Decker conversations, you know, or most
right.
of them anyway. So it was important to find a new role for them all.
So now that you're back over here, so are you over here in the United States full time again, or is this just for the summer that
we get
you?
Oh no, not yet. No, I'm still.
Okay.
I'm now doing the 6 month here, 6 month there routine. I'll go back at the beginning of November and do some hibernating during the winter and catch up on things like my website, and which needs desperate updating and all that kind of stuff.
So when you go back over there, what do you find to be passionate about in the wintertime? That, because I'm going to be just real honest with you. You know, I sit here at the beach here in Southern California. The weather is like this pretty much 360 days of the year. We get a little rainstorm. Everybody has a cow. And, you know, then we all go about going back to the beach the very next day. So I have like no concept of what it's like to live in a climate that, to me, when you say Amsterdam, all I think about is like frozen tundra. It must be like the North Pole and horrible at least 10 and a half months
actually,
of the year.
It's actually very mild in Amsterdam.
Really?
I mean, it snowed once last winter, and it was gone by the time I woke up.
Wow.
Rain is our default weather.
Okay.
It's wet. So you stay in a lot. I mean, you go to meet people, but, you know, they're a nice day. As soon as the weather warms up in February, a little bit, March, people are out on the terraces immediately. You know, wrapped in jackets and heated terraces. But the Dutch are hardy people.
And they like potatoes, I found out.
Oh, they do like potatoes. They do like their potatoes. Yeah. And but for me, I when I say hibernate, I have a weakness for things like So You Think You Can Dance. The Dutch Flemish version. I like to watch the little dancers do their thing. I think whether they're hip hoppers or jazz dancers or ballet dancers, they work really hard. And the thing is, those kinds of shows in Europe, they're not quite as nasty competitive as they are here. they really, there's a kind of a, the, all the dancers support each other and work with each other and they're happy for each other. And, you know, here there's a, there's an edge to those kinds of programs that makes it hard for me to look at. But the one in Holland with, I don't know, the, especially some of the ones from Belgium, they're really sweet. They're really, I like Belgian people. I like small countries, you know, New Zealand people.
So do you have
small countries?
So what do you have as a, because I like food of different cultures. Do you have a food dish over there that you did not like when you first vacationed or went over there, and now it's like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever?
Well, not that I didn't like, but I didn't know about Indonesian food.
Okay.
And that's what the Dutch do. I mean, the Dutch don't do it, but that's because the Dutch are culinarily challenged. They really have a problem with food. I don't, they, a lot of cheese and bread and meat and potatoes. It's really simple. But Indonesian, there's a lot of Indonesian because Indonesia was a Dutch colony.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Lots of people come over there. So, and as a matter of fact, it's what, when I come back here, I like to go to a regular Chinese restaurant because most of the Chinese restaurants in Amsterdam are kind of Indonesian twinged in terms of food tastes and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's just delicious stuff. You know, it's really, I that's the big surprise. For the rest, you know, the Dutch have some weird things. They have a thing called a croquette, which is like a deep fried, some kind of meaty gravy thing in the middle, but no one has ever been able to tell me exactly what is inside a croquette.
You just don't know. It's that mystery.
We call it mystery food.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
It's not, the Netherlands is not a country that I would say would be vegan friendly.
You got to get ready to eat your meat.
Yeah, well, they have vegetable soup. It's got meatballs in it.
Yeah.
For sure. No question.
Yeah.
That's just the way it comes. So,
David, we're getting ready to wrap up our time together. I can't believe the hour has flown by, even with the couple of minutes of technical difficulty. I tell you, it just flies. For people who are out there who are either budding writers, either young at heart or old in spirit or somewhere in the middle, what advice would you give them now as a successful published author?
Well, you know, once a long time ago, I was interviewing P.D. James, the British mystery writer. And I said, you know, what I love, what, why you are so inspiring to me, as I said, you started writing at the age of 40, and I was 40 then. And I said, I still would like to write. And P.D. James put her hand on my wrist and said, David, it's never too late to start writing. And, you know, so having a, and she was writing until she was 92. My first book was published at the age of 62, so I got 30 years of a writing career potentially ahead of me. And that's because I just sat down and did it. You know, I mean, when you're ready to write, just write, you know, and it doesn't, don't think about, I actually wrote Calvin's Head as to get that story out of my head so I could write a real book.
Wow.
Yeah, this book sort of has taken on a life of its own and encouraged me to write more books. So it's, I think however you do it, just you got to sit down and write. Don't think about it. Just sit down when you can get yourself to do it and do it. And then see where it takes you, because every writer's path is different. Every writer's path
yep.
is different. You know, I don't go for those, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do that. The one thing you have to do is actually write. But for the rest, how you do it, that's all up to you.
I love that. A writer writes always. And you know, it's silly. I remember that line from Throw Mama from the Train with Danny DeVito and Billy Crystal. You know, they're in that creative writing class, and the conversation goes, and the teacher says, writer writes always, you know, and that's so true.
Yeah.
Last shout-outs of the night. Is there anybody you want to say hi to, give high fives to, and then tell us how people can either find you on social media or your website, or where you like people to stalk you on the internet?
Oh, yeah, I'll go with that first. You can stalk me anywhere. I'm kind of a social media slut.
There we go.
I like it. I like following people. I like seeing what they're doing. I like, you know, I like the back and forth that happens sometimes. You know, especially every once in a while it gets silly. There was a great silly conversation recently about why do men throw their ties over their shoulder when they're taking a piss at the urinal, and I learned a new word, backsplash. I love social media for that kind of stuff, you know. Like, I never, and you, so you can find me on Facebook. Everything is David Swatling. I don't hide my name. At David Swatling for Twitter, David Swatling on Facebook, David Swatling WordPress is the website. You know, you can find me anywhere, and I'm happy to get in touch. As for saying hello to anyone who is interested in reading and books, because without you, without the readers, why am I doing what I'm doing? So those are the people I shout out to.
Very good. Well, everybody, it's been my sincere honor and pleasure to have Mr. David Swatling. His book is called Calvin Said. You can get it on Amazon. And do you have a preferred place you like to have people to buy your book, by the way?
No, whatever suits people. It's on Amazon. It's on iBooks. The audiobook is on audible.com. My publisher is boldstrokesbooks.com. They have the books. But I also love it when people go to little bookstores. My book's not usually in bookstores because it's, you know, it's kind of hard to get them there. But, you know, wherever it's easiest.
So do that, folks. Go out and buy David's book, Calvin Said. So many twists and turns. You're going to think that it's the episode of Dallas when Pam goes to the shower and opens the door, and it's Bobby Ewing standing there. You're going to go, no, he didn't. There's too many of those twists and turns, and Calvin Said. Thank me later. Go buy the book. Support this novel and the next one, and we'll have you back for that book. Everybody, it's been Rated G Radio. We'll see you live tomorrow night with Mr. Richard Wynn with Wynn Locations. We'll learn all about that industry, and it's been just a real pleasure. David, thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you, Garrett. You have a great night, too.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.